Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics to cover during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website, and the link can be found on our front page of our website in orange color type. But if you would like a simple URL for your browser to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater's signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NVB will join us as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com.
Good evening, Roy. How are you doing today? This is KD2VEA.
I'm doing perfectly fine. The computer wasn't, for some strange reason. It seems to have forgot that it had a cursor, which is rather important.
KD2NVP, Roy, before I heard the last part about the cursor and the computer, but before that, you dropped out mid-sentence for a while. Maybe you're aware of that, maybe you're not. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, the best of times, the cursor has to be placed in a particular position for the computer to know that I'm hitting a trigger. So, that's one of the problems with interplaying with radios with computers and such, that if your window is not in the front, it doesn't care what buttons you press. So, what can I tell you? Anyway, we're open for business now, I hope. I hope everything continues to work. I haven't had a real good opportunity to arrange all the windows the way I like them, but they're all open and hopefully operating. So this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, fellows. If anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, please feel free to hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Roy, this is KD2VEA. I do have a question.
Certainly, Maxim. What's your question for tonight?
So during our net last night, there was some radio transmission playing music, and I thought it might have been stray, but then in the end, like, probably somebody was messing with the repeater. I'm just curious, like, what kind of remedies do we actually have when somebody decides to, you know, pollute the airwaves?
Okay, that's kind of the million-dollar question. I'll share with you that it got so bad at one point when Dick A2RIW was running the Limark technical net that he came on at 8 o'clock and he hit his push-to-talk button. And he had the ability, may he rest in peace, to listen in on the repeater while he's transmitting. So if anyone's trying to jam him, he could hear it. And so he hit the push-to-talk talk at 8 o'clock. Someone started to jam him, and that was probably the 500th time that he had complained about it. So he basically just threw the push-to-talk mic on the floor, walked away, and didn't come back to the technical net for about 3 weeks. Limark tried all kinds of interesting devices. They went on fox hunts. They used Doppler detectors to figure out where these jammers were. They got to the point where they came up with a fascinating idea. They planted little receivers all over Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island that listened into the input signal and reported to a website so that you could see approximately what region had the strongest signal, and you can kind of figure out where the jammer was. The bottom line is they're problematic. Usually, if you don't react to them, they get kind of bored and they move to some other place. The worst thing that you could possibly do is interact with them and start to argue with them. I remember years ago, a guy was so furiously arguing with a jammer that when the net control operator turned the repeater off, the guy on the repeater went to the output frequency so he can continue to argue with the jammer.
That is very interesting. Not much we can do that. That's very, very fascinating. I was just curious, because like, we kind of most ignored it, but it was certainly not as helpful while we were trying to, or run the net. But I thought I got the radio news out.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, there's not a lot that you can do. If you have some people in the club who are very close to the repeater site, you can try to overload it. You know, if you give a strong enough signal at the repeater site, you'll capture and go full quieting and block a jammer's transmission. Or you could, that would be kind of the defensive move. The offensive move is traveling around with a Doppler and trying to figure out where this guy came from and report him to the police. And unfortunately, reporting jammers to the police tend to be kind of pointless. There was a jammer in Queens, and it was only after he had screwed around with the airport and used police frequencies that the police finally arrested him for drugs and other things. Police don't really, they don't take it seriously if you tell them that a guy is jamming you. You can complain to the FCC, and as long as the jammer consistently jams you for about 2 or 3 years, then you'll get something. But, if it's a kind of hit or miss type of a thing, they won't get out of their chairs. Limark had a guy who they knew who he was because he was a member of the club at one point, and he was doing things. So finally, right before he passed away, I think the FCC fined him a couple $1,000s that he couldn't afford even if he didn't die. So it's problematic. It's not that much of a nuisance for us because, the repeater isn't that active, and you can't really annoy that many people by doing it to our repeater. So my guess is if we do nothing in a couple of weeks, this guy will wander off to some other place.
Yeah, and likely will be very bored because, the repeater most of the time is boring. I'll keep our fingers right there. All right, well, that was my question. I want to chat with you about something else, but let's see if anybody else wants to weigh in today.
Okay, very good, Maxim. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at approximately 9 p.m. My computer works. And we're open for business. So if anyone out there has any questions or topics that they'd like to discuss, preferably of amateur radio, but we're open to a lot of different scientific and technological aspects of life. Anyway, anyone with any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign. Well, Maxim, it looks like we have loads of time for your other question or comment.
All right, then. On the Discord part, I think I gave you all of the administrative privileges. So I was thinking, so I created a couple of permission type when I was messing around with it. So if you look at the server setup, one of them is a member. So I was kind of thinking as people join the Discord, we could tag people with the right type of permissions based on their status. So for example, I have you tagged as an admin and as a member. So as people join the Discord, we're definitely members. We can tag them as members so they can also tell who's a member, who's not a member. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. It's a good thing that you have that type of a feature. LimeArk has this weird little chat room that was free. They had it long before I ever kind of joined them on the technical net. And the last few years, I've had to lock the darn thing down because if I leave a chat room open 24/7, eventually some person will come by and hawk dirty pictures of supposedly themselves. So it's a good thing because if we get particularly popular, you might end up with the same type of goofy situation where people just wander by and make noise. So I think it's a good idea.
Cool. So yeah, at some point I'm just going to sit down and look at our rosters and tag people. For example, like I see N2RGA, Mitch is on here, so I'm definitely going to give him a profile of a member and probably moderator. Why not? I think I have you both as member, moderator, and manager. So I think you basically have everything, including ownership. But as you see people join, if you could tag them as members, just so that everybody has that designation that they deserve it. I think you have pretty much all the power to run the thing as I do.
Okay, fine. I think I visited the Discord just today. It is basically, kind of what you would expect for the first few days. It's a bunch of guys saying hello. Hopefully it'll develop into something a little bit more profound. But when I get a chance, I'll go back to it. And I've never kind of run a Discord, so I'm unfamiliar completely with the command set. But when I emailed everyone, I sent them a webpage that kind of explains the ins and outs of Discord servers. I know a lot of people don't like to read manuals, but it'll save me. Well, probably won't save me anything because there'll be someone who says, "How do I do this?" Where are the instructions? It'll probably be a response to the message about the Discord server that includes the link to the page that explains it all. So, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, pretty funny. This is KG2VA. I'm not big on kind of manuals either. Mostly just play around and figure out because I've done quite a few of these things. Discord is new to me too, so it's kind of nice to play and figure out how it works. Because I just set up a community on WhatsApp as well that definitely has a lot more features than WhatsApp does. But, that is more, this seems like a more technical piece of software than WhatApp is. Nonetheless, I also gave Berlat a moderator and manager access, so she has it. So I gave a couple of people back there. I just don't necessarily recognize all the call signs. I see Todd, KE2AEU. I just got to see his fully paid up member. That's the piece I need to see. Because I don't think I have the latest roster yet, because we haven't done playing Wallet. Once we do, it'll be nice. This is going to be, I think, more useful, not necessarily for day-to-day communication, but like when we do a quota or park outing, do a little bit more communication on the fly, and then or field by day as well, getting things organized. It's more, I think, on the day off than anything else. Anyways, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an experiment. We'll see if it's a success. Hopefully, it'll be a partial success. I don't think everyone's going to regularly visit it. But it's a nice little added feature to the club.
Yep, definitely something to think about. Looking forward to our meeting on Wednesday, next Wednesday. Start talking about field day and kind of what we want to do. Start making inquiries there. That should be interesting. That's pretty much all the technical questions there for now. I might come up with something else for that. No, that's all I got.
Okay, very good. We'll probably have a somewhat short net tonight. My computer is still acting weird. It's very strange. It was perfectly fine an hour ago. And I don't know, someone cast an evil spell on or something. So I don't know exactly what is going on with it. Nevertheless, this continues to be Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here hopefully to help people with technical questions. So if you have a question or a technical topic for discussion, then please hit that push to talk and put your name down on the list. Well, it's really going to be a quiet night. Maybe we should just kind of jump to the TechNet puzzle for tonight. It's rather simple, fortunately, because I've lost control of my cursor again, but it's in the right place for me transmitting, which is the most important thing. Nevertheless, the TechNet puzzle for tonight, the question or premise is components in a tuned circuit may need high voltage or current ratings because, and then it gives you four possible reasons why you should overrate your components in a tuned circuit. Choice A is inductors and capacitors generally become less effective as they get older, which is an interesting answer. Answer B is most tuned circuits are used with vacuum tubes, which require high voltages, which is another interesting answer. Choice C is high voltage and circulating currents may exist when the current is operated at resonance. And choice D is the voltage across the capacitor and inductors will add in phase. So, does anyone wish to hazard a guess of what of the four reasons is the correct reason of why you should probably overrate your components in a tuned circuit?
ZV here.
Hello, William. Did you hear the question for tonight, the puzzle?
I sure did, and based on the way I feel these days, I think it's definitely the reason is because we get older and we don't work the same way we did, and that's what is actually happening to me, so I think it probably happens to everything.
Well, I agree with you. It happens probably to everything, but it's really not a good technical answer of why you overrate your components in a tuned circuit, because as far as I'm aware, non-tuned circuits undergo the passage of time as much as a tuned circuit will.
It all depends on what you mean by overrate. I mean, you could choose 10% resistors or 1% resistors or laser-trimmed resistors, and laser-trimmed resistors are definitely overrated.
In the case of this question, when I'm talking about rating, it's power rating. So in other words, as a non-resonant circuit, you were expecting, 5 volts and 1 amp. Do you get components that are rated for 5 volts and 1 amp, or do you get multiples of that as the power rating for the components because they happen to be in a tuned circuit?
As far as that's concerned, I would say that typical steel safety ratings are 2X, and if I was going to make a tuned circuit for a very expensive radio, I would probably go 10X because the instantaneous peak power is a lot different from what you can measure RMS-wise, and you don't want any smacks coming and knocking out components and causing warranty repair items when you could just pay a few more cents for a higher rated component.
Okay. I mean, in general, I think you're talking about good practice in engineer designing electrical circuits, that if money is no object, you get things rated for much more power just in case. But here, what they're really getting at is what's the difference between a tuned circuit and all the other circuits? And why do they especially require being very conservative about the power handling capacity of the components that you design into a tuned circuit?
That you would want the tuned circuit to stay tuned, especially over temperature. And so that's another issue that happens with tuned circuits. They change over temperature, and so you need things to really be stable. So you choose the most stable operation. I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Okay, but again, you're kind of taking it as just a general component. Now you're talking about thermal issues with the component. This is primary. The real underlying question is, why do you need to have components capable of handling higher power in a resonant circuit? That if you want to distill that question down, that's really what they're asking. What's special about a tuned circuit in which you need to multiply the amount of voltage and current? Is there something wonky going on in a resonant circuit that doesn't go on in a non-resonant circuit that warrants the treatment of putting in higher power handling capacity components within the portion that is the resonant circuit?
Well, now that we've totally beat that one to death, I would say that the answer is C, which is definitely the high voltage and circulating currents may exist when the circuit is operated at resonance.
Very good, and you would be correct. It is the concept of resonance. Resonance is sort of kind of like a short-term energy storage phenomena, where it swings back and forth in standing waves. And I mean, it's not going to store up the energy forever, but it stores it up for a short interval of time enough to kind of do its magic. So when that's part of what, when we talk about the quality of a resonant circuit, the Q, one of the many, there's about 20 different definitions of what Q is. But one of the definitions of Q is the voltage and current multipliers due to the resonance of the circuit and the other qualities. So, you know, you could have five times the voltage on a resonant circuit than you put in because it's bouncing back and forth and back and forth before it gets used up someplace else. So you are correct. The answer is C.
Which makes me question, really, why we ever came up with the Q as the name of this, because if it's Q, it sounds to me like we're talking about quantum energy or something like that, but where did the Q come from?
I think the use for quality, which then got shortened to Q, might have even been before quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics kind of started around 1905. And I think oscillators and tuned circuits and such even predate that. So, I mean, the Q factor of a resonant circuit has multiple different definitions. As you increase the Q, you narrow the bandwidth. So, you know, a tuned circuit in an oscillator that uses, say, a capacitor and an inductor have a relatively low Q. It has a little bit more variation. Whereas if you use a crystal oscillator as a crystal in an oscillator, the crystal imparts a very high Q. So it's a very, very sharp frequency. And there are a lot more. If anyone goes to Wikipedia and looks at a quality factor or Q factor, there's an endless list of different ways of considering what the Q factor of a resonant circuit is.
Yeah, I remember when I was during the early days of digital communications, we had to have extremely stable oscillators that actually were crystal oscillators, which were much better than the synthesizers of the day. And the crystal oscillators had less sidebands, and they had a very much sharper Q than the other synthesizers. And so one of the problems with synthesizers was there was wide sidebands which put out additional digital noise, and then you couldn't get the same BER with a synthesizer as you could with a crystal. And so as a result, we had to have these crystal oscillators, which you had to order 16 to 18 weeks ahead of time so that they'd have time to age. Sometimes if you wanted super special, you'd have to order it like 6 months ahead of time. Anyway, back in those days, I suppose it's the same way now because there's probably those same crystal ovens running everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still crystal-based. It's a little bit more finessed. The crystal usually doesn't have to be a specific frequency and doesn't have to be changed. It's usually a reference signal, and then there's an integrated circuit, phase lock loop circuit, that uses the reference from the crystal oscillator to determine the final local oscillator's frequency. So yeah, things have gotten finessed a lot more as the years go on. You know, nowadays modern radios don't drift. You can kind of tell when you're talking to a guy on HF who's talking on a radio that's about 30 years old. It's a little drifty around the edges. Modern day radios with a lot of times they have an ovenized reference crystal. They have a phase lock loop. Occasionally, they have a GPS driven timer in it, and they don't drift that much anymore.
That's true, but what we were doing in those old days was we had to cut a specific crystal for each carrier frequency. Can you believe it? Anyway, times have passed and things have improved so much better over time from the early 80s. But it's interesting that the Q, that the letter Q has been used so interestingly all throughout the development with quantum physics. And this Q, it seems like there is some kind of weird kind of correlation, even though the Q was quality and invented before, you know, we actually developed quantum physics. Maybe quantum physics also explains Q, and that's an interesting concept. What do you think about that?
Nah, I don't think so. That would be a rather long stretch. I mean, the problem is that there's only so many letters in the English alphabet. We ran out of them a long time ago, and, you know, sometimes people just shrug their shoulders and use them multiple different ways. I mean, you know, when you're supposed to be writing, a document, and you use the term kilo, you're supposed to not capitalize it. A lot of people get that wrong. It's a small K because because a capital K goes for Kelvin. So you got to keep your letters straight. But you know, there came a time that they ran out of Greek letters and Roman letters, and sometimes they decided to play little games like complex numbers. If you ever learned about complex numbers, there are real numbers and imaginary numbers. The imaginary numbers are I times something, I being the minus the square root of 2 or something. Minus one. Anyway, so the imaginary number line is I. But when it got to electronics, because I is current and would drive the electrical engineers crazy, they decided to use the next letter in the alphabet, J. So if you look up complex numbers by mathematicians, it's I. If you look up electrical engineers, it's J. And that's been all over the place. In mathematics, I think it got so bad that they started to actually use Hebrew alphabet for number theory. For infinite series is designated sets called Aleph. There's Aleph null, there's Aleph 1, Aleph 2, Aleph 3, and such. So it's just there's not enough variable terms in the universe, and people just reuse them to everyone's confusion.
One of my pet peeves is that people don't capitalize Mr. Hertz's name in HZ and Mr. Bell's name in decibels, but it seems like those are cemented into electrical engineering. And when I learned electrical engineering, first I learned math with I, and then I learned J omega. And J omega was totally different from what I could do, because J omega did lots of other things. And now I've looked into some three-dimensional stuff, and it's IJK. So we're just going on and on with this stuff.
What you're alluding to is called, as opposed to complex numbers, these are quaternary numbers. So they're hyperdimensional. They're very useful in doing translations in 3D space. So they are easily found in the algorithms of 3D video software, quaternary numbers. I did a whole thing about the series of imaginary number lines in multiple dimensions on the Limark Science Talk a couple of years ago.
I think that'd be a fun listen. Is that on one of the Roy pages somewhere?
No, I never wrote it down. It's on amateurradio.tv. Has archives of the audio of the Limark Technical Net. Unfortunately, the only thing he lists it as was the date of the transmission. So I don't know offhand what day I did that particular one. I used to do, you know, before Dick passed away, the job I kind of gave myself was to give science talks about different subjects. I did one talk about how numbers progressed from positive integers all the way to things like quaternaries and such. And another time I did a presentation on the Big Bang. So they were interesting at the time, but I never really published anything. It was just for the Science Talk segment of the Limark Technical Net back probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I guess.
That's well before my ham radio license days. Anyway, I think that's still interesting stuff. We should try to dig it up. Hey, thanks a lot for the puzzle tonight. I don't know if anybody else is out there listening, but did they also, would anybody else want to venture a guess? Was anybody there?
Well, I know Maxim is out there, and of course our co-host Bob is out there. But I figured I could kind of talk you through it to resolve the answer that way. So that's the way I kind of decided to play it this particular Wednesday.
Trouble with the station. Go ahead, other station.
It's NVB. I was just saying, I was thinking of entry, I guess, but I only got as far as either C or D. I didn't really know. So I was happy to listen to your discussion and your guess.
Great to hear from you. So it's only you two guys out here tonight on the TechNet? Nobody had any questions?
Yeah, Maxim is here with us, and he had a couple of questions before you came.
That's good, because I'm late. I got a new scanner, and it is not operating correctly, and I'm having lots of fun. You know how that is.
Yep. It's always good to have a new toy. I try to get a new toy every so often to just... you know, something new to figure out, especially when it doesn't work.
Yeah, when it doesn't work, you can test out tech support and see if they reply and see if they're, you know, where it came from and everything else. But it seems to work pretty good, but it has a connection problem. Aside from that, it does work, so, you know, I'm happy with it.
Okay, that's good. I mean, I loathe and despise technical support. Occasionally they're useful, but only occasional. I have a Prusa XL multi-tool 3D printer that is printing in the background. I hear it from across the house. And I had a problem with it. It works using the individual tools. There are 5 tools. But if you try to use them all together, one of my tool kept on crashing into the base. It didn't understand how high it was supposed to be. It thought that it could go 2 millimeters below the base, and that usually didn't work out well. So I was confused, and rather than go into a chat room, which requires you to kind of wait about 5 hours online, I tried their technical support via email, and they responded, "That's interesting. If it's repeatable, take a video of it and send us the video, and we'll tell you what we think." So I took a video of it, and I sent it off to them, and I didn't get any immediate reply. So I kind of figured out myself. What happens with the multi-tool is that it levels the first tool to the base, but it doesn't level any of the other tools. What it does is look into a table, an earlier calibration table of the offsets of the other 4 tools, and goes accordingly. And since I had changed the nozzle of the second tool and hadn't recalibrated its distance correctly yet, it was taking incorrect information and assuming that the base of the printer was 2 millimeters lower than it was. So I just basically recalibrated it, and it started to work. And I kept sending emails to the tech support that wasn't responding to me, and about 2 days later they said, "Oh, great. Well, if you ever have any other problems, let us know." So that was what they gave me, pretty much nothing.
ZV, yeah, I get the fact that they pretty much they read the manual back to you, and they have a standard email reply. that they dump out that you have to pass through. It's like Apple tech support. When you call Apple, you got to figure out how to get past the first level and stump the band. And then if you can stump the band, you get to second level. And if you can stump the band at second level, then you really get a smart person. It's very hard to stump the second level band, and usually I'm satisfied. But I know what the tech support routine is all about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem, the basic problem is the cost. To hire an engineer who knows what he's talking about on the phone is very expensive. So instead, they hire people who are idiots, and they give them an algorithm on a computer screen, and that's as far as it goes. And I've kind of jumped a level or two and actually talked to someone who had the faintest idea what's going on. But almost 90% of the time, either while I'm waiting to be connected or while there's a pause in some guy getting another guy to tell me the same thing that the first guy said, I try every permutation until I figure it out, and then I've solved my own problem. I once had this weird conversation with a guy, I think from the Philippines, where he was kind of reading his algorithm, and at the end that I solved the problem for myself, he says, well, it was a pleasure helping you. So I said, well, it was nice meeting you, but you didn't particularly help me. You just kind of sat there while I figured it out. And he said, well, yes. So I'm glad it worked out. Have a nice day. So it's like talking to a Labrador retriever with a voice synthesizer, unfortunately.
I'm a little like you because it becomes a matter of focus. If I'm on the tech support call and I'm waiting for them to answer or whatever, I'll focus on the problem a lot more than I will if I'm not on the tech support call. And so by the time they finally answer, I've got a lot of stuff figured out, but I usually have extra problems because I've gotten like three layers deeper than I was previously screwed by. So, you know, eventually it does tend to work out, but it does take a long time. So I usually have to set aside an afternoon, get started about 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, and plan on not anything else for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I dread talking to technical assistants. The primary reason I use those lines is really to either send in a faulty item for a swap or, you know, some repair or something. I have a Chinese, one of those small things that blows air very, very fast. Has a lithium ion battery inside of it and a relatively high power little air pump, and it completely failed after about a year. And I contacted the manufacturer, who told me to contact a distributor in the United States, which is a company that almost everyone's dealt with through Amazon. It's called Pergear. And their response is a lack of response. I have sent Pergear a bunch of email to different addresses and never received a single answer. So the manufacturer of the item very kindly said, well, we'll send you an RMA and you can send it back to us and we'll fix it for you and turn it around. I said, gee, that's great. Then I looked at the cost to send something back to China, and it's about $70-$80. You know, for about $10 more, I could have Amazon send me a brand new one tomorrow. So that's kind of the scam with Chinese manufacturers. Their distributors are irresponsible, and the quick, easy shipments only go in one direction, from China to us, not the other way around.
It means that you have to catch it within the first 30 days and give it back to Amazon. There's no other way.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of things don't die in the first 30 days. So, you know, what can you do?
That's what they're counting on. Well, one of the things is that I've really realized is how much our buying power in terms of technology has increased over my lifetime. It's just incredible to think what my first Hammerlin radio cost versus what you can get, you know, in a fully transistorized chip radio and everything. For the same amount of money, you get, like, so much more. I mean, dollars, obviously, but still, to my mind, I didn't realize it multiplied by 10 while I was sleeping, growing older, or maybe more, but it still seems very amazing to me that for a certain amount of money, you can get so much more technology than you used to be able to.
AC2GS. Well, you know, as I often say on all these technical nets, that we're living in a kind of technology golden age. It is happening at such an accelerated pace that if you sleep late, you'll miss some kind of revolutionary discovery. The amount of technology that costs pennies to manufacture, that takes up fractions of a cubic millimeter are astounding to me. And I don't know if we'll ever reach a limit. I'm sure we will, but when, who knows? I mean, surface mount devices are a pain in the backside. You can't really fix most of them anymore. But I mean, it's amazing the amount of electronics you could pack into such a small volume and, you know, make them relatively smart components. They do all little extra things that no one even thought of back in the old days. And we benefited from it in a way, but we've also kind of degenerated into disposable consumers. In the old days, you took it to a fix-it shop and you fixed it yourself and, you know, you held on to it. Nowadays, if it burps the wrong way, you throw it in the garbage and then pull up a screen and order a replacement from Amazon.
I remember when a cable was just a wire that had connectors on the ends, and now these days the cables are so much more. They have like built-in electronic chips inside the connectors, and that they can do so much converting like one format to another inside the connector. You know, it's just amazing, and it's just so small. You just plug it in, you think nothing of it, but it's not wires to wires. It's got chips inside.
In the old days, because there was, you know, in the old days you had vacuum tubes. No one in their right mind would say, you know, maybe we should solder a vacuum tube to the end of the connector so that it could do something special. So, I mean, it just wasn't theoretically possible. But now you can put an integrated circuit inside a connector jacket and, you know, not even be aware that there's an IC. You know, there are integrated circuits on a lot of different connectors. Apple, the connector that's kind of going out of fashion because the European Union threatened to sue them, has a chip, and sometimes it goes bad, and then it doesn't handshake, and then you got to throw it out. You got to buy another expensive one. So yeah, nowadays there's a lot of chips built into the connectors at either end of the cable. You know, it's just part of what technology has wrought.
Are you referring to the Lightning connector, and then the European Union wants them to use USB-C? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, the Lightning connector has a proprietary chip in it that can go bad, and then you basically have no choice. You got to throw it away and get a nice new shiny one.
I got a Lightning connector that's supposed to convert. You plug it in the bottom of the iPhone, and it's supposed to convert your iPhone audio into left and right stereo. And it seems like one channel is screwed. So it's like, it's hit and miss with this stuff. And so I got like stuff going back to Amazon this week.
Well, yeah, I mean, I find usually if you buy the expensive stuff from Apple, you get higher quality. If you buy the Chinese stuff, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes one of the channels doesn't work. You know, the supposed benefit that they were promoting with Lightning, among other things, is that you could output audio, you could output an HDMI connector. I have an extender where you plug a Lightning into your phone, and it has a connector, parallel connectors. It has a power connector, I think a USB, and it has an HDMI jack, so you can plug out the video output. So it's a very versatile connector design, and it's also symmetrical, so you don't have to worry that you're putting it in the right direction. Both directions are the right direction. But USB serves the same purpose, and it's more readily available, and Apple doesn't control the chips. So I think that's the reason why it's going bye-bye. I am a big fan of USB-C connectors. I think we'll still have the old USB-A's for a long, 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 long time. But I really like the fact that you don't have to worry about is it right side up or upside down or what it is. That it's a nice symmetrical connector, and it just works.
Because the USB-A that is USB 3 has got all these extra contacts in there, so I think the USB-C is kind of like a much better rendition of all of that.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I just generally call it the A. The form factor is designated A. You could have an A that's a USB 1 or 2 or 3. It has more connectors inside of it. But it's not symmetrical. So there's a right side to plug in the A's and the wrong side. As opposed to the C's, both sides are the right side.
I know. I got just so frustrated. I just bought a new USB-C hub. And we'll see if that works, because there's just too many USB-C things sitting around and so few ports on my laptop here. So I think that this is going to solve a lot of problems.
Well, yeah, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. If it's not powered, you could get some problems, because if you plug them into the computer, they're plugged into the power bus, whereas if it's an unpowered hub, it takes whatever, you know, 5 watts or whatever that particular port has and spreads it out to all of the ports that it's taking. So a powered hub is probably better than an unpowered hub. And, you know, sometimes if you string too many hubs one after the other, it makes the USB relatively flaky.
My hope with this one is because it passes the power through from the main power supply, it's going to suck power off the main power supply and power the ports as well as the computer, especially since the computer's battery is usually pretty well charged, you know. So I'm hoping to run the power through this hub into the computer and then have powered ports, but I don't know if that really will work like that. So that's going to be an interesting test, because I've got drives that are powered, you know, from the USB-C port that I want to plug in there and see if they come up properly, so, and they pull, you know, more than nothing.
Well, basically, there's two kind of ports. There are ports that just have a plug, and then the case has 2, 3, 5, 7, whatever jacks. Those are unpowered. Those are problematic. If you plug in a bunch of things that don't draw too much power, you might get away with it. Because internally in the computer, there's a chip that controls the one USB that you've plugged into, and that has a rated amount of power. And if, you know, for one device, it's not a problem. But if you have a hub that has five jacks, and you have five different devices feeding off of that one computer output, you know, USB, then you got problems. The other type of a hub has in addition, it has another jack where you can plug a power wart into, and it supplies most of its own power to the devices hooked to the hub. So in those cases, you're not going to run out of power, depending upon what the power rating for the powered hub is. So, you know, if you buy yourself a powered hub that only puts out 10 watts, then, you know, when you get to the 12th watt, you're in trouble. So, you know, if you get a powered hub that's rated for 50 watts, you got a lot of power in that wall wart.
Well, this one doesn't really have a wall wart. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the computer power supply that usually plugs into the side of the computer and run it through this, and hopefully this is going to also suck off the wall power supply that's powering the computer and provide additional power to the ports without having to rely on the computer to provide power back in the reverse direction. So anyway, wish me luck.
AC2GS, I wish you luck. I don't think they're designed to do that, but it'll be an interesting experiment.
The thing now that basically puts USB through it, and then it gives you one USB type A and another adapter that goes to HDMI or DVI or something like that, and then that goes in and powers the computer. So I'm trying to replace that with this new device that'll have all USB-C ports, because it seems like that would be an easier way to go, and then I could plug this device into that. But we shall see if this works.
Yes, indeed. Well, I wish you luck, William. Let me see if anyone else is out there. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and we're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at around 9 p.m. Anyone out there has any technical questions or topics that they would like to discuss, then please hit that push to talk.
Hey, Roy, this is KD2VA. I just want to say good night. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Very good. Have a good night's sleep, and be well, and thank you for being here and participating. I do appreciate it. Well, it kind of looks like the technical net is petering out. I will just once again ask if anyone has any closing questions or comments, please make them now.
Doubled with someone, AC2ZV.
Okay, whoever I doubled with, hopefully I'm not doubling with them now. Please repeat yourself.
82NVB, I was just saying I have an interesting anecdote about going through a whole process of repairing a camera lens that I ended up fixing myself and avoiding an offense and an expensive shipping to some store in another state and everything else. It's kind of interesting.
Sure, I'd love to hear it.
Okay, a few months ago, and essentially, I do some work as a photographer, mainly photograph, well, just one account, the Harlem Chamber Players, they're online. I've been their photographer for like 15 years. And a very standard lens for photographing performing musicians, concerts, or events is a 70-200 2.8 telephoto zoom. And it's a big, heavy, pretty expensive lens, and it stopped autofocusing. I went to a job, and it just didn't work. It didn't auto. It turned out it was just this little part, a copper contact had fallen off, the part that connected to the camera so it could tell the motor in the lens to autofocus. So, you know, I call, and it turns out there's only one authorized Pentax repair store in the whole country, and the minimum charge for fixing this big, heavy, expensive lens, oh, is like close to $500. It sounded like, well, no matter what it is, ridiculous, you'd have to ship it in. And I went on forums, I did research. Seems to be a common problem with these, some of these parts are kind of vulnerable. If you don't take the lens off, or when you're changing the lenses, you don't do, you could maybe knock it off. Maybe I did something like that. But, and one guy, you know, they said they don't sell parts. It turns out it's just a part that one guy managed to get from a place in Belgium 5 years ago, and it turned out it cost him less than $40, including shipping. So I called around, I tried. I couldn't get anybody that would send me parts. It's kind of a racket. They force you to send it in to get it fixed, even if it's something as minor as this. So I finally, this morning it was suggested that maybe these parts are the same in their other lenses, and it turns out yes. So I used a much cheaper lens I have. They're all Pentax lenses. Like a $400 or $500 lens I've had for 10 years, and I took a little chance, and I also got these JIS screwdrivers. You probably know about these things. They look like Phillips, but they're better for Japanese products, including radios, I would imagine. And I got the proper screwdrivers. I took out this part with these tiny screwdrivers, and it turns out, yes, same part. I just swapped them. I can buy another used copy of this cheaper lens on eBay for like less than $150. It may be just as good as what I have that I've had for 10 years, or if not, I can swap the part out again. So that's my story. But it took me a while to figure all this out, and I had to rent a lens a few times, cutting into my paychecks. So I finally fixed it yesterday, and it's working, and I feel great. So that's my story.
Ah, congratulations. That was good detective work. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you got to really think of, you know, think a solution out. And sometimes you can do something, sometimes you can't. I mean, with my little air blower thing, I kept on pleading with them, just give me a damn source for the lithium ion battery. I'll crack it open, unsolder it, and replace it. And unfortunately, they said there is no source other than our factory, and we don't sell parts. So congratulations. That's great. I'm curious. I watch too much YouTube. And this week, the lens that seems to be promoted by everyone for some strange reason is a Chinese one. It's a 10mm 2.8 autofocus. Have you seen any YouTubes on that?
No, but I haven't been looking at any of that stuff except for my hobby lately has been bird photography, and unfortunately, to go for the really great stuff for that, I could spend close to $10,000 for these mirrorless cameras with the lenses. But no, that type, I don't know about that one. Is it, so it's a Chinese knockoff brand, I guess. They say it's really good and it's not so expensive. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's a company. It's called, I think, Laowa. I have a couple of macro lenses. They're kind of known for their macro lenses. They're kind of innovative in the way of design. Their quality is decent, and this is kind of a step up, apparently, because their macro lenses are kind of manual focus, but this is their first autofocus model. And it's a rectilinear 10 millimeter, so it's not a fisheye. So I don't know what dark magic they did. I don't think you can buy a rectilinear 10 millimeter lens out there other than this one now. And it's not that really expensive. I think it's about $600-$700.
That's not bad, but actually, what I've got, I have it's just a Sigma lens that, I mean, I have it for Pentax, you could have it for the other brands, a 10-20 zoom, you know, ultra wide zoom that once in a while I need on these jobs if I'm super close to a large ensemble. Of course, the people on the edge start looking like funhouse mirrors, so it's tricky. But, yeah, that wasn't too expensive. It was like a $450. I think I got that lens, maybe 8 years ago or something. And I also have these companies like Samyang or Rokinon. They're all kind of the same brand from what I've gathered from reading things on the internet. But they're manual focus. And I got this really nice, almost circular fisheye. If you put it on a four-frame camera, which I have, 8 millimeter, it's almost circular. It's some little flat edges in the top and bottom. And that was only $200-some, and it's a good lens, but it's manual focus. But it, something that wide, you got such a depth of field that manual focus isn't a big deal. But I'd be curious about this other one. And also, it's 2.8, which is they always cost more. So, what's that brand again?
It's called Laowa. I mean, if you go to something like B&H. And just search for a 10 millimeter 2.8 lens, it'll pop up. I don't think it's shipping in the United States yet. They've just sent it to a bunch of YouTube influencers, and every single one has played around with it. I mean, you can focus it, something like touching the edge of the lens. It focuses something like 2 or 3 millimeters from the lens surface.
Wow, you probably got some really trippy macro photos of a totally distorted flower or something. So it's a 10 millimeter prime. It's not a zoom, right?
Yeah, it's a prime. But the big thing is it's not a fisheye. It's all rectilinear, so everything stays straight. I mean, it does get distorted at the edges depending upon where you position it, but they're still straight, which is weird. I've seen lots of fisheye lenses at that size, but I don't know of any that's rectilinear.
Actually, they're not that uncommon. I mean, my 10-20 zoom is rectilinear. It's not fisheye. Miners, I always thought they were just about as common. I mean, the fisheye are the ones that people really want to be exotic, they all talk about. But, and of course, it's a different kind of distortion. Yeah, as you say, so the closer to the edge, the more distorted. Something that the person looks like he's very short and fat. Oh, can't use that, or I'll have to crop him out, because that's just too weird, you know. Anyway, back to you.
The Venus Optic Laowa 799 at B&H for that 10 millimeter lens.
Yeah, I but it's not available yet. It's coming soon, it says on the page.
Oh, one other thing, NVB here. Roy, is that a lens for a full frame camera, or is it just for APS-C? Because when I said my 10-20, it's actually just an APS-C lens, so which means full frame would be like the equivalent of 15 millimeter.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's a full frame. It's they have it in a Sony mount. They have it, I think, in a Canon mount. They have it in a Nikon mount. They have about five or six different mounts for it. Some of the mounts are not autofocus. They're manual. I think there's two mounts that have the autofocus motor in them, but it's full frame.
It's full frame. So I guess I hope the ones without the autofocus motor are cheaper.
No, surprisingly, they're the same exact price. They're all the same price, with, you know, just different mounts. But even I think there's the manual focus has more pedals on the diaphragm for the aperture.
Oh, right. That's supposed to. I'm trying to remember exactly what it's supposed to be. Better quality. Maybe it's better bokeh, the blurry background, or just smoother. I think that's what those things, more whatever they call them, pedals. Yeah, do they have them in a Pentax mount? The biggest problem with Pentax, which is what I have, is that a lot of these camera companies have stopped making Pentax mounts. My options are more limited.
I don't know if they have Pentax. If William is still looking at the page, take a quick look to see if there's a Pentax mount.
I'm not sure there, but keep looking.
I would tend to doubt it. I think there's something like six different mounts available, but you know, you got to go where the money is, and the number of Pentax owners is only going to go down over time. They're not going to go up.
Things says Sony E version mount. There's no options for that. You'd have to have maybe a Sony E to Pentax adapter if that's possible.
It's a perpetuating trend.
Yeah, unfortunately, the two of you doubled. Yeah, I mean, theoretically, you could buy another lens with another mount, and if you have a Pentax adapter for that other camera mount. I just was curious if there was a Pentax version, which I didn't remember seeing.
AC2ZV.
They don't. That's usually the case, but if you had six different mounts, that's quite a while. I guess there are a bunch of... Yeah, you got Panasonic, you got Olympus, I guess... Yeah, whatever, but my bets are that they don't have it.
ZV, you win. It was a Sony E mount, and unless you have an adapter for that, you lose.
Okay, but there were a lot of other mounts. It's not only the Sony mount. I saw the Sony mount. That has a, at least the one I saw had the autofocus motor in it. But there's about five other entries on B&H for it.
But like I say, usually... You got a super wide lens like that, autofocus becomes very less and less important. It's such a depth of field range there. It's quite easy to shoot manual with the focus with a lens like that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's less important when you get to that ridiculously wide a range, you know, unless you set it for, you know, right in front of the lens. You know, if you kind of set it a little bit back, it'll go from there all the way to infinity.
Right. You got to think about it a little. If it's super close, you don't set it to infinity or something like that. I mean, but there's a wide range.
Yeah, I agree.
How do you spell that brand again?
I believe it's Laowa.
Laowa. I'll just write this into... Oh, I got it. I'll look at it. I mean, it's their whole page. I'll look up 10 millimeter.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. Like I said, I own a couple of the macro lenses. They have this one that I've seen on YouTubes a lot. It's something like a almost 1.5-inch tube that goes about 16, 17 inches long. It's a ridiculous kind of macro lens that really gets into awkward places. You know, it's reasonable quality. You know, it's not a Leica, but it's decent. It's not plasticky. Matter of fact, this particular 10 millimeter, people discussing how it's all metal, and it's a very strange color. It's kind of a dark blue instead of the generic black color that most lenses are.
Yeah, it reminds me of my Samyang, Wokinon, whichever one I have, that fisheye. It feels very solid, good quality metal. I mean, it's manual focus, but it was like $230, and that wasn't even a Black Friday or anything. I just what it costs. It's actually quite sharp, 8mm fisheye.
Yeah, they've been doing pretty good things with optics in China. I'm not quite sure why, but apparently it's something that they take interest in, and they seem to be doing good jobs. You know, there are some commodities that kind of everyone sort of knows, like everyone knows DJI drones. They're kind of the best drones you can buy right now, and you know, so you know, there's a lot of quality issues with a lot of generic Chinese stuff, but you know, the odd occasional manufacturer, I guess, decides that he wants to be known for quality, and you know, I think that works in their favor.
Yeah, I also have these flash that I got recently. Godox or something like that, G-O-D-O-X, it's Chinese, I'm pretty certain. And these are good flash units, and for a whole, well, it was a Black Friday sale, but even without the Black Friday sale, for like $300, I got this interesting, fully functional, good camera flash. I got all these, like, accessories, including a remote one, so I could put the flash somewhere else and have this transmitter. All for, I spent $300, and the Pentax flash, just the flash, would have been $400. But it seems like good quality.
AC2GS. Yeah, I have some Godox stuff. I have Godox flash and some light panels.
Right, if you got the little master or whatever you call the thing that you put on your camera, that, like, I guess light panels, I mean, does it communicate wirelessly to activate remote flashes and things like that?
Yeah. I bought it a couple of years ago. It may not be the current model, but I got the remote transmitters toys, and in my shack I have a remote control for Godox devices, because they use a lot of the exact same remote controllers. So I kind of peppered my camera bag and even left one in the shack.
Yeah, I mean, the remote thing, I got it for, like, I think it was normally not that much, $70, I think. I got this stuff Black Friday, so I got it for like $50. It wasn't that big a savings. But it was like, I bought this really nice lens that really helps me on my jobs. It's a wide-angle zoom that cost $1,400, but I was $300 off for the Black Friday sale. So I ended up getting all that stuff plus the lens, kind of like getting the lens and having that other stuff thrown in for free, because I needed a new flash for my camera. So I'm pretty happy. And I don't know how to... I'll have to learn how to use a remote flash. I never got into that advanced thing with flash photography. I just put a flash on my camera, you know, and I bounce them off luckily I was using white ceilings around. I just bounce, and I get good pictures that way. But there's a whole art and a science to that that I try to get to find a good book on how to use this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, in principle, I'm sure there's going to be some books. The actual models, the most you're going to be able to get is YouTube's, because, you know, it's a little too new. I've been into LED strips lately. I don't know if you've ever seen, in the old days, people had this idea they were pushing for televisions where there's a backlight to kind of, so there's not that big difference between the illumination of the TV and the darkness in the room. And then as time went on, companies, it failed for televisions for the most part, but third-party companies would sell LED strips, and then they sold them with HDMI connectors that sampled the display image and changed the background lighting according to the video source. And then they had one where it's a little camera that pokes off the top and looks down at the screen and does the same sort of thing. So I've been playing around with one of those. It's amusing.
Is it for photography, like flash or something, and to see what kind of effects you get, or for something else?
It's unrelated to photography. It's just LED strips. It's used as backlighting for television sets. So you're watching the television at night in the dark, and it leads the color of the screen behind it on the wall. So if there's a big fire in the movie you're watching, the background is illuminated, flickering red lights and such. So it kind of gives you the sense as though your screen's a little bit larger than it really is.
Or maybe the feeling like your house is on fire.
Well, I hope not. But I mean, that the idea is it kind of smears the color to the background wall, which hopefully is white. Mine is. And it adds a little bit of an accent. It's not a dramatic difference, but and I've used it sometimes as a night light, so it's an interesting thing to play around with.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Speaking of LEDs, this is off a different topic, but the way they're putting these new LED lights in the subway system that I can't stand. They're so, I mean, I thought I didn't like fluorescent, but these things are like too bright. I've got a bit of light sensitivity. And the one that really gets to me is this, my 7th Avenue Q train station. I try to swipe my card to see how much is on the card, on the Metro card. The light they put above it is so bright, it washes out the display, and I really can't read it. So anyway, back to you.
Yeah, I think it takes a while for these people to kind of understand what lumens mean. You know, they think that they're getting a real big bang for their buck because the efficiency of LEDs over fluorescence or incandescence. But, you know, you can't have too much of a good thing. And so eventually everyone's going to learn their lesson, I hope. Also, it depends upon the manufacturer and design of the LED. A lot of them are a little too blue heavy.
Yeah, maybe these are blue heavy. They just look like bright white light to me. Like, they're just so bright. I mean, it makes the old fluorescence by comparison look nice and warm.
That's a function of the phosphors, usually. It depends on the technology, but a lot of times what's going on is they're all begin life as a UV LED, and then different types of phosphors cover them that glow red, green, and blue. And if you don't get the chemistry, the mixture quite right, it doesn't give you a kind of pleasing, light quality. You know, I mean, you work with different temperature lighting for photography, and, that's an art as well. So, you know, there's so many different ways of getting it terribly wrong. So I think they're all going to get it wrong until hopefully someday they'll figure it out and get it right.
Yeah, it's very bright and institutional, this stuff. I have nothing but LED lights in my apartment now, just light bulbs. I just replaced them all. And these particular ones I have, they look kind of warmer than the incandescents in a way. I mean, it's just that the way they tuned them, so I know it doesn't have to be that way. Side note, while you're talking, all of a sudden I think my batteries have gotten low in my smoke detector, and it's screaming at me every couple minutes the way it does when the battery's low.
AC2GS. Well, that's always fun. What can you do? That's the bane of most people's existence. I just put up a new smoke detector in my house, and rather than screw it to the ceiling, I decided to use magnets that hold it up. So, you know, if I ever need to grab it and change batteries, I rather than having to kind of grab it with two hands and twist it clockwise or counterclockwise, I just need to kind of pull it away from the magnet on the other side.
Mine, I went and just, like, I didn't want to deal with the landlord saying, get me a new smoke detector. So I just spent $30-$40 to get my own. So I bought one at a local hardware store, and the screws, the things with it, you hook it up, the screws they already put in for the other one, they're like in the mounts or whatever you call them are in different places. It wouldn't work. So I just have it like kind of leaning against the wall on top of my piano.
Okay, that's a solution. I mean, I just decided that I didn't want to putz around with a ladder and drill holes and then stick those plastic fasteners. And I went through Amazon and found this entry for, you know, some 3M adhesive pads and magnets. And I said, that sounds like a good idea. So it took me all of about 4 minutes to do.
It sounds much better. Same here. I didn't want to, like, re-drill these screws and what have you. Standing on a chair, you know, or something like that. It was up over a door opening, you know, between two rooms.
Yeah, whatever, as long as it works. Meanwhile, our two Echo Link people have dropped off of Echo Link. It's a good thing that I have I have an iPhone logged into Echo Link, because the way that I get into both Echo Link and the radio through the computer requires someone to log on to the Echo Link server. So when the two people left, I would basically be silenced if I didn't have another entry.
Right, good. Well, I think I have to take off. I have to do a couple things around here. I'm going to try to get this battery out of this. Well, I think I just fixed it. For now, I'm just turning the smoke detector off so it doesn't scream. I'll have to get a new battery next day or so. Maybe I have one sitting around the house. Is anybody still, is William still out there? I think I'm going to probably say 73 pretty soon. Back to you.
Yeah, I think we're going to call it a night now. I think everyone's kind of logged out of Echo Link, and probably they're not kind of standing over their radio. So thank you, Bob, for all that you do here. I appreciate it.
Anyway, for all you do. It's a pleasure working with you. It really is. Back to you.
Thank you. Likewise. So, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be April 3rd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each of every month at 9 p.m. And we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 or nearby upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services are generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time for us to roll this all up, but we'll be back April 10th to do it all over again. You're welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy AC2GS going clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS clear.